Welcome to the Senate Finance Committee. Today is Wednesday, January 18, 2017. The time is 9:03 a.m. If you're joining us off-net or online, we're in Juneau, Alaska, the state capital, up on the fifth floor. So please feel free to join us. This is the first meeting of the 30th Alaska State Legislature. I want to welcome all the members present. Senator Hoffman, welcome back.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman is co-chair of finance and will chair the operating budget. Senator Machicki, welcome.
Morning, Madam Chair.
The Senate's majority leader and a member of Senate Finance. Senator Olson, welcome.
Morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy, welcome. Senator Natasha von Imhoff, welcome to Senate Finance. Senator Click Bishop, vice chair of the Finance Committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning to all, and I'm Senator Anna McKinnon, co-chair of the Finance Committee, in charge of the operating budget and bill management. Would any members like to offer some opening comments before I thank and introduce our finance team?
I'll make a few comments.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have gone through our savings accounts in the last 4 years. We've spent over $13 billion. 4 years ago, we started out with a balance in excess of $16 billion. So it seems to me that we're in the final hours to make monumental changes to the state so that people can enjoy the services that, that Alaskans have come to enjoy. It's going to be challenging. I feel very confident that the Senate has organized under a president that is knowledgeable about the process. He was co-chairman of the Finance Committee. This committee has tremendous experience. We have one new member that comes from Anchorage but has extensive finance background. And I think that we are here with the capabilities to address the financial concerns that face this great state, and people of Alaska should continue to put pressure upon us to get the job done. With that, I'm looking forward to working with the members of this committee, the members of the other body, and the administration to make sure that services to the people of Alaska continue.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Any other comments? Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think most of us know that we're kind of running out of time in terms of a budget. And I think that's going to be one of the driving forces that I hope gets us all to coalesce around a multi-year approach, a multi-component approach. And I want to say that the what the Senate's come up with so far in terms of looking at the budget, I think is a very good start. And I think it's a template that we all can work off of. It's been said you can't cut your way out of this, but you can't get your way out of this without cuts. And that's just a fact. We just cannot support the size of the government that we have right now. I'm looking forward to more discussions that we'll have shortly on our concept of a revised appropriation limit to hem us in so that people of Alaska feel good about if and when they have to contribute more to this issue. And so look forward to working with everybody at this table, in the Senate, in the House, and with the governor's office. We can make this happen if we all pull together, but it's going to be a multifaceted approach to get it done. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Senator Bishop, did you have a comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to say also, right, you can't cut your way out of it either, but you got to realize that you have to have new revenue as well. You have over $2 billion deferred maintenance. You have an industry that's in recession. You have another industry that's starting to go into recession, and we need to be cognizant of that, and we need to act prudent. And deferred maintenance is my pet peeve. It's not new to anyone here at this table or anyone here in the state. And I look forward to working with all of you to keep Alaska healthy and moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chairman Bishop. On today's agenda, we have a budget presentation, but we couldn't do the job that we do without the support of a great team. And we acknowledge that team when we leave session and when we start session. And it is my privilege today to point out and I hope provide information for the people who are following us on the internet, on the TV, wherever you might be listening to what the people's representatives are attempting to do for all Alaskans. We have that team. They post things for the people of Alaska. They record everything that can be picked up on microphones. They do an amazing amount of work that goes unnoticed and is a seamless process so that the people of Alaska have access to the business that is happening in these walls today and every day throughout our session. So I would like, if they would stand, so that I could recognize them in this order. Donnie, if, our Senate Secretary is Allison, Laura, Jessica. Join me in thanking them for all their hard work. In each of our offices, we have an entire team. I won't introduce my whole team, but I will introduce who will be assisting us with finance and so that the general public has an opportunity to call individual offices if they have questions or communications. I'd like to start with my chief of staff, Laura Kramer. Laura, if you could. And Julie Luckett. So if any of the people of Alaska or anyone on the finance, on your finance team as members, need anything, please feel free to call Senator Hoffman's office or my office. We have a great team. And with that, I'll let you introduce your finance aide or your entire office if you choose. Senator Hoffman.
My finance aide is James Armstrong. He has extensive experience. And my chief of staff, Tim Grusendorf. Both join me. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Behind me, brought over from the House, we have Mr. Pete Eklund, who will be my finance aide.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. We have Denise Licciola, who's my chief of staff as well, and my finance aide, and has been my finance aide for the last 10 years.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you. Behind me, we have Daniel George. He's been in the House the last several years doing finance and other matters, and I'm just pleased to have with our team this year.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Senator Von Emhoff.
With me here is Bridger Vance, a recent graduate from UAA with an economics and math degree. Brilliant young man.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike Smith, my finance aide, has been with me now going on 5 years. So thanks, Mike, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. I wanted to make sure, again, it takes an entire team to make everything work around here, so I wanted to thank Gavel to Gavel, Misha and Skip, as well as the LIO support team, Cody and Greg. In addition to that, legislative finance, this is the budget, the budget, the budget. Legislative finance is led by David Teal, and we have in the room Rob Carpenter and also Lacey Sanders supporting us today. So we have a full complement, ready to do the people's business. Senator Machicki, did you have additional comments?
I did not, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I'd like to invite Office of Management Budget Director Pat Pitney to the table. Do you need a moment, or are we ready to roll? If you could introduce yourself for the record. Drill, baby, drill, right?
Okay. My face will turn red. Sorry about that, guy. Thank you. For the record, my name is Pat Pitney. I'm the budget director for the Office of Management and Budget for the Walker administration. I would like to take the opportunity to introduce my staff that are in the room as well. We have Kelly O'Sullivan. She's our kind of the right-hand person on the budget. We have Sylvan Robb. She's our policy analyst. And back in the corner, we have our capital budget analyst, Adam Bryan. So thank you very much for their support. With that, thank you so much for having this the first out of the gate. We appreciate that. We look forward to working with you throughout the session. Will be some serious conversations, but good conversations that are necessary to solve this fiscal crisis. Similar to last year, but maybe not quite as intense, we've talked to many public groups and forums, and I've used this chart to talk about the situation that the state faces in terms of our fiscal environment. And our income is down more than 80%. And if you were thinking about household terms, that's having an income of $80,000 a year going to $16,000 a year. In that same time period, our spending has been reduced by 44%. So that's like going from $80,000 down to $45,000 a year. And that means you might have moved into a smaller house and have less rent. You've reduced your heat. You're not eating out. You're traveling less. You have that beautiful cabin that you wanted to, in your mind that you wanted to build, you've stopped building that, and you're keeping your car a little bit longer. And that's a significant reduction in expenditures. At the same time, you've pretty much drained your savings account. You have 1 year left. Fortunately, you have an investment account, and now you have to decide how to use that so it lasts your entire lifetime, and for the state, that means forever. Even after all those actions, you still have a gap that needs to be addressed. And so this is how it looks. Translating our, you know, $8 billion down to $1.6 billion revenue and our $8 billion down to $4.3 billion expense, this is what it looks like. The governor's 2018 budget and fiscal plan is directed at assuring safe communities, resource development, and economic security for everyone in Alaska. There's three components very similar to last year's budget introduction. We're continuing to reduce spending. We have a proposal to draw on the permanent fund earnings. It's the same proposal that this body passed last year, and protect the dividend. We've also included one revenue measure, but it will take more revenue measures working with both the House and the Senate to decide what's appropriate to actually close the gap. But we've introduced one, and that's the motor fuels tax. Setting the context in the total budget, so often we talk about the state budget. That's where our fiscal gap is. But there are other components besides the unrestricted general fund. So 33% of our overall state budget comes from federal funds, and that's pretty equally split between DOT, transportation, Medicaid financing, and all other federal programs. Other state funds are things like the Permanent Fund Corporation, their management fees, the Retirement Board management fees, AHFC, those are kind of the larger pieces, the International Airport Funds. Designated general funds comprise 10%, and that's largely, well, it's fees like tuition and fees and marine highway fees, but it's also, quasi-endowments for things like the power cost equalization and higher education funds. Also, the permanent fund dividend accounts for 7% of the total, and then the unrestricted general fund accounts for just 42% of our total budget. In total, this is a trend of our unrestricted general funds. We've come from 7.6 in 2013 down to, we're at 4.33. This is operating in capital both. It's a $27 million decrease on unrestricted general funds from last year. I'm not going to go into too much detail on this slide. As at the end, I'll open it up to questions on the fiscal summary. But this just provides a summary of where the reductions have been taken from 17 to 18. So if you're looking at the unrestricted general fund column, and for those watching online, I'm on slide 6. At the unrestricted general fund column, the major reduction is in the agency operating, the non-formula area, at $127 million. The increases were largely in the statewide components, debt, retirement, oil and gas tax credits, and with capital, that $127 million reduction in agency operating was reduced to 46 on operating and 27 total. But you can see where other reductions and additions were taken.
Spitney, if you could pause for a moment, we have a question. Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Pitney, can you back up two slides, please?
Two slides? There? Where?
That was a whole bunch of slides.
Yeah, that one?
Yes. Okay. So on that, our general fund, UGF spend was 4.3. The total with PFD was 10.2. There's a $5.8 billion difference. If you click to the next slide. If you overlaid the total spend on that slide, would the proportion be about the same, 60% other spend and for approximately 40% UGF? Would that be consistent across the board?
No, the other, if you looked at the other, the federal, other state funds and designated general funds, those have been increasing slightly. So if you looked at, say, 2013 or 2014, the general fund proportion would be closer to 60%, not 40%.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you. If possible, I'd like to see that slide.
Absolutely.
I think it's important for folks to understand. And this, my opening comment, if I was going to say anything, was going to be the fact that we have reduced from almost an $8 billion budget when this finance team gathered in 2013. We cut a billion pretty consistently for 3 years. Pretty significant reduction. So for those that aren't focused on what has been a success in reducing our spend, I can't find another state that has done a 44.6 reduction with capital and operating pretty much in history. Pretty significant cuts. I mean, it's not that cuts have not occurred, and we all agree that we need to keep edging down on the general spend, but that's a pretty significant accomplishment, and I think it's something that's often lost to the public. But with that overlay, will help us understand the proportion of federal and other funds that are coming into the budget. Thank you.
Any other questions? Ms. Pitney, please continue.
So this is a slightly different look at the change from 17 to 18. There were agency reductions, so these are true reductions in spending, agency additions, cost pressures up, fund source changes. So on the agencies as a whole, 123, the oil and gas tax credits, the debt service and the REAA funds increased by 76, leaving our operating budget down just about $50 million. With capital, then you come of a $20 million increase, and you have a $27 million net change in the unrestricted budget, 17 to 18. Few examples of the agency reductions. First, I want to thank the Senate for their work on Senate and House, for that matter, on their work on justice reform and Medicaid reform. Some of our largest reductions were due to the fiscal notes on those bills for corrections and for Medicaid. Additionally, the furloughs that were negotiated into the contracts, as well as the pay freeze bill, are included in the reduction. We also have another slight reduction in the Marine Highway system that adds to that. So the fund source change, or the additions, are the increase in employee health care rate, as well as some justice reform reinvestment items. The fund source change is largely the introduction of the motor fuels tax that is directed at the Department of Transportation, highway maintenance, marine highway system, and rural or airports, our state airport system. That accounts for $69 million of that $83 million in fund source change. The remaining part of that 83 are shifts to federal funds as part of the Medicaid reform, and some fee increases, both Fish and Game and Department of Natural Resources. So, and I think the big thing is that all of the cost reductions in the agency operating were largely offset by the statewide items that are formula-driven for the most part. So this is just another example of change over time. This is looking back to fiscal year 13 and why we picked fiscal year 13. It was the peak. Then we have fiscal year 15. The reason we've picked that is that when this administration came into office. And then, of course, our fiscal year 18 proposed budget. Agencies, not counting the K-12 distribution to communities, is down from over $3 billion to under $2.5. That's $700 million plus decrease. The K-12 is only slightly higher than it was in 2013 and below where it was in 2015. The retirement and debt service component, again, thank you to this body for the biggest decrease there is in the retirement contribution. The deposit into the retirement account has reduced our on-behalf payments for our PERS and TERS. They are, however, increasing. That's a cost pressure up.
Senator Von Imhoff, do you have a question?
Okay, and the capital budget is the last 2 years. This year it's about $115 million. Last year was $96 million. It's about as low as it can go for us to meet our federal match. And I must say I agree with Senator Senator Bishop's comments at the beginning, we can only push deferred maintenance. We can only defer deferred maintenance for so many years. It'll have to come back onto the budget at some point. Oil and gas tax credits, that represents the minimum requirement at $74 million. That's a $44 million increase from last year. But you can see down significantly from where it was in 15. And then the permanent fund dividend above where it was in 2013 at our very peak budget, but below what it was in 15.
So on that point, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
So with this budget, what is the anticipated payout per individual for their PFD?
$1,000.
$1,000, thank you.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Pitney, we said this 2 years ago, and I'll say it again. This budget, I shouldn't use the word phantom revenue, but I will. You have a couple of categories of revenue that may or may not occur. I'm assuming that the governor is willing, if this legislature, which the Senate did pass Senate Bill 128 last year, but if a similar bill does not pass both bodies this year, I assume the governor is planning a similar veto to the $1,000 level. I assume it gets easier to make a step like that every year once you get it out of the way the first year. The second thing is the motor fuel tax increase. I mean, phantom revenue, I suppose, is a fair statement. Did revenue produce two budgets, one with those items passing and one without, because you're looking at a substantial increase if those pieces of legislation do not pass the legislature?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, to your first point, there is no plan. The plan is to veto there. He will face that decision if we ever get there. We very much hope we don't have to face such a decision, that we aren't still in a crisis at the end of this session. To your second point, the administration has produced one budget with the assumption that those revenues both pass. If they didn't pass, it would essentially deplete the remaining, not quite deplete the remaining savings. We would have just over probably around $1 billion remaining in savings if indeed those revenue measures didn't pass. Now, $1 billion in our CBR is not a prudent level for our state. If you look at best practice, both by the organization that Ledge Finance works with and the organization that state budget officers work with, they would recommend, given the volatility of our revenue, that we keep $5 billion in our CBR. That's a one-year reserve. The lowest we would want to go is $2 billion in our reserve.
Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki.
I can't disagree with you, and the reason I use the word phantom is just to put a telescope on that difference. If those two measures do not pass, it's approximately a $770 million additional gap in this budget with a full PFD payout and the $70 million that we would have to make up if the fuel tax increase didn't pass as well. Just complicates the gap significantly, and I think folks need to remain focused on that.
Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Pitney, how does this budget help the private economy? I mean, we're looking at how this helps the government sector. It's somewhat subjective, but some could argue we're, again, a little light on reductions, and we'll be asking more and more of the individuals of Alaska, businesses of Alaska, corporations of Alaska, to ante up more money to support the size of the government we have now. How does this budget help the private economy, the private sector that, by most accounts, has been in a recession? We have the highest unemployment rate in the country at 6.8%, climbing almost to 7%. How does this help that part of the economy?
Thank you for that question. Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, I'll start with first, we are using the state resources in this budget as much as we can to match federal funds. If you look at the federal funds in transportation, serves the design community, it serves the construction community. These are just straight up jobs in the private economy. On the Medicaid, where we've matched the Medicaid funding for health services, that is jobs in hospitals, in clinics, in many communities throughout the state. The other piece is we're maintaining a permanent fund dividend that has a retail impact. We're maintaining the payments out to communities. So, you know, we were looking at, and I'll have a chart further on in the presentation, 46% of our operating budget is sent directly out of the state to organizations, individuals, and communities. So 46% of these dollars in the operating budget are checks out to the communities. Now, those communities support each other. So property tax, in lieu of not funding those communities, there could be an impact on property tax, increases on sales tax. So we're protecting the communities from having that. That will have a benefit to the overall economy. So those are just a few examples, many more. And I was very encouraged by the Senate Labor and Commerce meetings here today and tomorrow on the overall economics of the situation the state is in, and look forward to recapping on those discussions.
Senator Dunleavy.
When the governor vetoed the other half of the dividend that was calculated through the decades-old calculation, it removed close to $700 million from the private economy. How does, if you can help me, and it's just not a setup question, but how does that taking the $700 million out of the hands of Alaskans, where some of your poorest will spend it in the state, in the private economy, how does that, taking that out to support what we have now as a government that we can no longer support through traditional means, how does that help the economy and those individuals by removing that $700 million?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, that $700 million is also the $700 million that in the future will pay for some of the programs that individuals throughout Alaska depend on, whether that be health care, whether that be education, whether that be roads. By doing that, we've preserved our ability to have the necessary state services.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator
Hoffman. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to bring this up later, but since you had mentioned that this budget maintains payments to communities, and then on your slide three, the first thing on the first page says you want to foster safer communities. Well, last year the Senate proposed to reduce the revenue sharing program. The governor was supporting a payout of $60 million for that total program, and we did not feel, with given the finances of the state of Alaska, that we could continue to afford that. The governor at that point did not even include the continuation of the program, so we changed it from a revenue sharing program to a community assistance program. And the whole concept behind that legislation was that it gives the communities the commitment that they're going to be receiving those dollars for 3 years. This budget doesn't ensure that. This budget does not fund continue to keep that fund at $90 million, which is the amount required for the continuation of the program, because it's whatever is in that fund, one-third of it is going to be spent the following year. So I'm wondering what the policy is of this administration regarding the community assistance program. You said that it maintains the program, but when I look at it in next year, the reason that the communities are getting $30 million is because last year the Senate put in an additional $30 million to the program, even though we reduced it, where the governor did not put no money into that program, but said that they supported the $60 million. So without the $30 million in the budget next year, if nothing is done, that the fund will be reduced from $90 million to $60 million, and you use the three-year average, the communities will only participate in a $20 million reduction. So I'm wondering, is it the intent that that this administration, this first year, phasing out the fund, or next year do you plan on adding $60 million to the program to assure that those communities will get it for the subsequent 3 years? So I'm just wondering what the policy is on not including the $30 million that those communities want to see as insurance for the continuation of the program for the next 3 years.
Ms. Pitney.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the intent of the administration is that we would put in $60 million next year, assuming we have stable footing. Without a significant steps towards a balanced long-term budget, that would be one that can't fit in our overall approach to state spending. Assuming that we have success in what we've put forward and working with the House and Senate on the remaining gap, that would be enough for us to put in $60 million next year.
So the question that I have is your definition of stable footing. What does that include? Does that mean that a piece of legislation like the rewrite of the PFD program would put us on stable footing?
It will take at least what has been proposed in this governor's budget, but maybe even more, because we're still running a $900 million gap with this budget and a $600 million kind of long-term estimated gap. So we want to see a long-term stable balanced budget.
Well, my response to that, I guess, is that this committee, more than any other committee, more than in any other administration, has taken that very, very seriously, and we have taken directive action to do that. But to say in two different cases that this budget fosters safer communities and maintains payments to communities, that is not the case. You have not included the $30 million to maintain that program, and this budget, I would say, would put warning to the communities that they may face a 33 1/3% reduction. A very, very substantial reduction after a 50% reduction, which we, as the Senate Finance Committee, felt we could not afford. Last year, the administration felt that we could afford a $60 million program. And it seems to be a complete reversal to the communities that I represent by the statements that you're giving here today to the Finance Committee. So it's going to be very difficult depending on your definition, to put the state on stable footing, but putting the potential 33 1/3% reduction after a 50% reduction in play. Any department that would face a 33% reduction in the state of Alaska, say the Department of Education, would be crying foul. Even if we had asked for even a 5% reduction, I'm pretty sure that many departments are going to be crying foul when we as a finance committee are addressing these issues. So I would say to the communities of the state of Alaska that this does not maintain the commitment to the communities that we put forth in the rewrite of the community assistance program. We had envisioned that we would give them 3 years of commitment. This budget gives you only 2 years of commitment. This is a complete reversal by the administration's position from last year.
Ms. Pitney, if I might, the budget that you've submitted to us prioritizes the replacement of a ferry over stabilizing funding to smaller communities. That's just what your budget does, and it falls short in other areas. We know it's a work in process, an opportunity to come together to solve problems, but these are just a few of the frustrations that are facing us after some pretty long hours in the last legislative session to prioritize security for local communities and stabilizing Alaska's economy, both for rural communities and for the largest revenue stream in our state, and that would be tax credits that help provide the offset of fundings. Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, just very quickly, Ms. Pitney, does the governor support a capping the size of government through a revised appropriation limit that is currently in the Constitution? So we're not chasing down revenues for a government that keeps growing. Is he supportive of capping the size of this government and letting the vote go to the people?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, that is not a discussion that we have had, and certainly a discussion that can be active during this session.
One last follow-up.
Senator Dunleavy.
Just going back to the PFD for one moment, you had talked about how by taking the PFD to help support government, folks will get programs funded. Is it the philosophy of the administration that the government knows how to spend the people's money better, or that the people know how to spend the people's money better?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, the philosophy of the administration is to find stability for all of Alaska. And that this is the expectation, $1,000 is about the long-term average of the dividend, and that the overarching is let's create some stability for the state so businesses invest and we take away the cloud of uncertainty.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Pitney, I hope you don't feel ganged up on, because that's not the intent here. It's just discussion about a budget document. We've had it for some time, and it's our first meeting with you. So I want to go back to Senator Hoffman's discussion, and this is one of the problems I've had with the – and I like the not doing business as usual thing. That's kind of our – one of our mantras this year. We're going to do things differently because we haven't been able to get there the way we've done things in the past. However, the reason I go back to Senator Hoffman's discussion is that this legislature passed the community assistance bill last year. Your budget has about $770 million in, I called it, phantom revenue that has not passed the legislature. Yet you eliminated $30 million in spending that has. And I'm not sure that that's the way I would have approached it. I would have either remained consistent with what has been supported by the legislature and included the community assistance program. Then you're just going on one side of the equation, right? You guys have kind of gone both ways, which I think is difficult for the legislature. I'm not disagreeing that the other major pieces of legislation likely need to pass, But if you add the $30 million that we have to make up, now we're over $800 million in addition to the $800 million that's already a hole in the budget, which puts us at about $1.6 billion. So the inconsistencies, I think, are going to be difficult for us to deal with, and we will deal with them. I mean, we'll work together on dealing with them. We'll make it happen here. But the community assistance program, I agree, we reduced the expenditures in that program by 50%. I supported that bill. The legislature supported that bill. The governor supported that bill. And I think as we move forward, we should use that. Look at it that way, that, okay, we have agreed on this is something we're going to do going forward. These other issues are something that we still need to tackle. I'll leave it at that. I think I make the point pretty clear. If something has already been through both bodies and has enjoyed the blessing of a signature by the governor, I think it needs to be in the budget. Mm-hmm. And if it hasn't gotten to that point, it's something we still need some work on.
Ms. Pitney, did you have a response?
Through the chair, Senator Machiki, I understand your point. I understand Senator Hoffman's point. This was a long discussion, and the rationale was this is a forward funding mechanism. Whether we put in $30 million in this budget today or we put in $60 million next year, the communities only get $30 million next year in 18. So we could work through the process, get the revenue solutions in place, and then put the $60 million in next year. I understand that this is not a position that this body appreciated from the administration, and it's certainly open for discussion and direction. It is, the governor is supportive of that program, but feels like we need our revenue situation and our fiscal crisis addressed appropriately.
Ms. Pitney, if the governor supported the program, it would be in the budget. Okay. Senator Hoffman.
You know, I think that's the major point. Last year, the governor said he supported $60 million this year, and then we said that was too high, so we were conservatives and cut it in half. And the governor agreed with that and signed the bill. He did not veto that bill. He signed that bill with a three-year commitment to those communities. So you're using this program as a carrot, it would seem, to get legislation passed. You could have done the same thing with education. You could have said, okay, we're going to only fund two-thirds of education for the BSA because we can't afford it as the state of Alaska unless you pass something. You could have done that with a lot of different programs that the state of Alaska spends and results in deficit spending. But you chose one that we agreed upon just a year ago. And a year ago, the governor was committed to $60 million. Today, he says he in this budget there includes funds for safer communities. That is not the case. It should say, unless you do what I want. And we are fully supportive of that and getting things done. But to do it in this manner, just 1 year, even though it affects both bodies, seems to be a slap in the face for all the fine work that this committee instituted.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Ms. Pitney, the Senate stands ready to work with the administration. I should speak for myself. I don't want to play games. We are all here to benefit Alaskans. Community revenue sharing should have been included in the budget. There are other things that should be included that are gaping holes. Our legislative finance will point out those holes, and we will re-present the budget so that we can outline for Alaskans where the holes are that may be being used for a political advantage in a debate further down the road. And I just commit to Alaskans that the Senate is going to take up
the things that benefit the people of Alaska, regardless of whether they're being used as maneuvers inside of politics. We are trying to set politics aside. We know that we're in a tough spot, and we know the administration is in a tough spot. We know that the other body is in a tough spot. We have to focus on things that will get us to the finish line in 90 days. I want to go home. I think my colleagues want to go home, and we just do not want to do business as usual. With that, please continue to present the budget.
So, narrowing down to just the operating budget, the peak year was $6.1 billion in 2014. We're down to $4.2 billion. Exact numbers are on the chart. Relative to the past, in nominal dollars, no adjustment for inflation or population, our agency operating, again, so this is now narrowing it down to not the statewide items, not debt service and tax credits and so forth, but just agency operating, people term as government, we're down to nominal dollars to 2011. Just inflation adjusted, we're down to 2008. Inflation and population adjusted, we have the same buying power as 2002. And just more of an informational slide. The guidance we provided to our agencies when they developed their budget are shown on this slide. You know, we started with, is it constitutionally required? Is it legislatively required? And then we looked at the importance of the service and then how best we could provide the service. When you're going through your subcommittee process, you could feel free to discuss this with the commissioners. At the agency level, all agencies have seen reductions. So we've adjusted commerce and transportation make them more apples to apples. Commerce is down 54%. That's excluding the tourism component on both ends of the equation. They're the agencies that has been reduced the most. You have only a few agencies that have not been reduced at least 20%. Health and social services, although a 15% reduction, has had the largest dollar reduction over this time frame. And that education reduction is largely due to a one-time addition that was in 15 that was taken out. So,
Ms. Pitney, could we hold on that slide for just a moment? I noticed that your budget that you've just presented, you just made the comment that you're excluding the tourism marketing from that number. So does that mean that that number would be higher or lower for reductions? Because I see this year's budget has moved it to the capital budget.
Correct. So thank you, Chair McKinnon. So commerce, if you just looked at the 15 to 17 without normalizing the tourism budget, it would be over a 70% reduction. The tourism budget was an in-house operation until last year at this time, and then it was transitioned to the Tourism Association. So now it is a named recipient grant to that organization in the capital budget. So explains that.
Thank you. For those who might be following online or off net, you can find all of the documents at akleg.gov. That's akleg.gov. If you click on the daily schedule, then you can click into the Senate Finance Committee document. So just a little bit of directional information to locate the presentation. We are on slide 12, getting ready to move to slide 13 for that presentation.
Thank you. This is a representation of the agency operating budget that has been valuable for me. On the education side, you have the K-12 payments to communities, the university, and AvTech. That has been, from 15, that's been reduced 9%. The green pie component, which is 44%, this is health, troopers, corrections, courts, public defenders. That's down 13%. This is where our justice reform effort, your justice reform effort, will impact. It's a very difficult budget to reduce given the nature of those expenses. All other agencies have been down 41%. And it kind of gives a feel for who's taking the majority of the reductions, but also where we have any move to go to get additional reductions. It's very, the choices get harder and harder as we go forward.
Ms. Pitney, the reason that the Senate verbally said the four top cost drivers at our press conference yesterday was because the administration has cut everywhere but the largest cost drivers. So K through 12, $1.3 billion of general fund money passing to communities to support teachers in classrooms and the use of that. In Medicaid, we have made a first step on Medicaid reform. You mentioned that earlier, as well as correction reform. You indicated that that saved dollars and cents, but I just want the general public to know that the reason, at least myself, and I believe others voted for those changes, are because we believe it saves lives. Under Medicaid and corrections, we're concerned with the opioid abuse, and we're concerned that we're throwing people's lives away by putting them in prison and locking them up forever when we know that they will be back on the streets. And so we are trying to deploy resources in a more appropriate manner to save lives versus saving dollars. So I want to be that to be very clear to the general public that these reform measures are not about cuts. They are about savings, and it is savings financially for the state in some cases, but more importantly, the safety of Alaskans with some of the issues that we're facing. And we will be taking both of those issues up under review this session to work out any unforeseen consequences that may not have been present during our discussions last session.
I wholeheartedly agree with your last statement on saving lives as well, and we're trying as much as we can for ongoing cost containments. We've come down dramatically over the last 3 years, or 2 years proposing into the third year of reductions. Our focus is beginning to shift to cost containment. We've reduced, there are 2,500 fewer state employees today than there were in 2015. We have limited cost increases for personnel through implementing furloughs, no cost of living increases, and most recently a proposal that will come forward to have all pay frozen for a period of time. We've also gone through travel restrictions. Travel is down $17 million. In this budget compared to 2015, and we've come down $3 million in leases and reduced our footprint by 100,000 square feet. So these are just some examples of the reductions.
If we could stay on that slide for a moment, there are multiple questions. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Pitney, last year we had on the first bullet, we had talked about that, and I don't know if we ever got a clear answer on these employees that are gone. Or are those real bodies, or are those vacant PCNs, and can you give me a breakdown, PCNs that were scrubbed versus real bodies?
Bishop, if you'd allow me. There is one other point, whether the PCN actually had funds associated with it. So there's sort of three different perspectives, if I could just offer that one as an addition. Ms. Pitney.
Yes. So these are paychecks. Department of Labor and Workforce Development provides a monthly report. The state has 2,500 fewer paychecks. This is real bodies in seats.
Thank you.
If we go two pages over, the position reductions have been 2,250. There's 795 of those 2,250 are in this particular budget. And I thank Chair McKinnon for pointing out that there's PCNs and then there's PCNs with funding. So you have, we have a PCN list. That is a number on a piece of paper, and only some of them are funded. That number on piece of paper holds characteristics and classifications that are required for hiring. So very much I'm working on focusing on the number of paychecks, and we're down considerably at 2,500. That's almost 10%. That was October to October. When you looked at November to November, it went up to 2,600. So it's growing. And we are down below, as the state as a whole, we are back to the 2002 level of employment.
Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you. As Senator Bishop said, this is kind of an issue that we've wrestled with the past 3 years because it's we're trying to define what it is. And you said there's 2,500 fewer paychecks. How many of the 2,500 though were full time FTEs? How many were temporary, seasonal, et cetera? And then I think most importantly is there a way to get what the actual savings was with the elimination of 2,500 jobs, a dollar figure, and then if any of that money was shifted to, let's say, contracts and contractors. In other words, what was the true realized savings from that reduction of 2,500 paychecks?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, the savings on that 2,500 fewer is roughly $250 million. You know, kind of an all-in average cost is $100,000, maybe $105,000. But that's $250 million of costs that had we not taken those actions would still be in the state budget overall. If you look at this position deletions, so the question you were asking about, like, does the money go to contracts or exactly and which people? The executive branch agencies, that information is available on an agency level. It'll be different for different agencies. That is because we have the payroll associated with those executive branch agencies. The other areas are not in a summary level available. And even the executive branch agencies, it's going to be different for every agency. But there's more information available there.
Senator Dunleavy.
So I think then in a way you answered the question, because if you're saying that those 2,500 fewer employees represent 100,000 folks, then that assumes that they're full-time year-round.
$100,000, I believe.
$100,000, right. Yes. Okay. Full-time, yeah. Year-round. So these are full-time, they were full-time permanent filled positions year-round with an average of $100,000 attached to their position, average.
The $250,000 estimate would be the calculation, okay. But I am not saying that is precisely that they were full-time permanent. It could have been a full-time non-permanent. It could be a part-time person. But on average, that's about what you're looking at.
$100,000 a person.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Von Imhoff.
How many actual pink slips were given? And the reason being is you've made this same presentation at Commonwealth North, and we pressed you on this particular slide and on this particular point. And you stated for the folks there that there was only about 40 to 50 people actually that were pink slipped.
In the first budget year, there was, I'm going to be close. The first budget year, it was 37. And the next budget year, it was 40. We actually gave 80 pink slips, but people that chose retirement prior to the date that it would be executed, or they chose to resign, or they found a different job, it was down to 40 by the time we actually had to execute it. We work very hard to manage with attrition. Our hiring restrictions, we scrutinize every replacement employee. The budget, the way we put the budget out, on December 15, we identify by position number. If you are an employee, that I say that that's the first pink slip. If you're an employee and you're in one of those PCNs that are identified for deletion, the prudent thing is to go find a different job, because that's the governor is recommending it to be deleted. There's more that come onto that list when the legislature starts addressing program reductions. As soon as the legislature puts them on the list, again, it's a known position. If that person is in the position, it's prudent for them to go look, and most do. And that's why we're able to do this with fewer pink slips. And we're actually looking to manage this through attrition and not disrupt the individual. And as an employer, if you're reducing your workforce, you often give incentives. We don't have that option. What we have is the option to tell them, we're going to recommend this position, it goes away. Sometimes as early as September or October, a commissioner is saying, this is the program that's going to be introduced for reduction in the governor's budget. And then that employee says, my job's going away, I better go find another one. So we've come down to, we've only had, less than 80 that we've actually had to execute the pink slip so that they leave on that day. When we do that, that's unemployment insurance and other factors that we've avoided on all of the other ones.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Through the chair, thank you. Well, I actually went, and we may just have to kind of look at the 2,500, because I went report by report and agency by agency and counted the number of employees and put them on a spreadsheet and saw that the actual number of employees between 2015 and 2017 was about 1,200 less.
Pitney, if I could, let's provide the administration an opportunity to come back with some refined numbers. We had a similar situation, if you recall, in the last legislative session where we felt like we were getting, I felt as the chairman that we were receiving different information, and numbers can tell a different story based on how they are presented and what's associated with them. We just had a brief conversation about PCNs. Senator Bishop and I had had a conversation that it costs money as a former commissioner to actually develop PCNs. So sometimes it is helpful if you think there is an opportunity to reclassify something to have those PCNs without dollars associated with them on the books. And sometimes it is good to just eliminate them, because we will never return, or at least not for a long time, to $150 a barrel oil in an economy that can support the current size of government. Ms. Pitney, we are concerned with the numbers. That concern is stemming from how a private sector business would respond to a deficit that the private sector might face versus what a state government might face. In the private sector, you have one board of directors. I would assert that there are multiple boards of directors. In our government, we're a bicameral legislature. We have an administration, and we have a court system. All of those different perspectives have value and support of the people of Alaska, but we need to get standardized numbers, because we do have people from all perspectives feeding us those numbers differently. So, Ms. Pitney, the PCN, if we can cross-check those personnel numbers in a variety of ways, if we can get down to the detailed description of seasonal, non-seasonal, those that we've had to let go. I've heard Senator Kelly speak I believe I'm getting the quote close to accurate in saying that all jobs are important, both in the private sector and in government. If you're a family that depends on a paycheck, your family is devastated if you don't have that paycheck coming in. For the state versus a private sector employee or employer, if we lay folks off, Ms. Pitney said, they come back to the state of Alaska and they sign up for our unemployment that employers have contributed to and paid into. And there are other benefits that they might access that causes increased spending from our side of the table that other private sector employees might not see. Beyond unemployment insurance, if they access Medicaid programs or other services that the state or the federal government may provide, there are ramifications. But all jobs are important. Private sector and government jobs are equal in some eyes and unequal in others if we can't afford it. Union and non-union jobs are important. So I just want to say that there are we're looking at these numbers very differently, and we would appreciate some drill down. And, in fact, the drill down on that entire slide that you presented, Ms. Pitney, would be helpful. If you're telling the people of Alaska that we've eliminated pay increases, we'd like you to be able to corroborate that with the documents that describe that to how it was done. If you have, in fact, limited or reduced executive travel, we'd like to see where that's been implemented and give us the associated dollars. And if you've consolidated and reduced leases, as has said, if you could let us know how that has taken place geographically, we'd appreciate a fine-tuning on those numbers. Did I see Senator Dunleavy or Senator Michiki? Senator Michiki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, this discussion is, we've had it many times, and I really do think it's in your best interest to provide that document, split out by department, what type of employee, whether it be seasonal or not. You know, it's funny because some of the public focuses on those pesky public employees, and they're the first ones to worship the greater driver when they make it possible to get from home to school, or the state trooper when he shows up after an incident, you know, on the highway or something. But we have a tendency to focus on that. And I've got to say, the private sector is not different. And I, when I'm not wearing the hat in the legislature, I'm in another industry that has suffered significantly from the reduction of oil prices. We have made cuts, but we do our best to not hand out pink slips. We encourage people to retire when it's time, sometimes a little early. We have incentives that allow them to do that. When you look at the number of positions in the oil and gas economy right now, there's been a significant reduction. When you look at the amount of people that have been laid off, it's much smaller. So I think it's in your best interest to share those numbers so that we do understand where they are. And I would put it, organize it in a departmental cut. What we do here in cuts translates into less employees. And if we can understand that translation, it might be a better way for us to handle our cuts in the future. So I know it's difficult to put that together, but we'll continue to have those questions until we can have a document where we can go out to our constituents and say, you know, there are 2,500 less positions. Pink slips do not translate directly. It's not a direct correlation between reduced positions and less and the amount of people on the payroll. So it would be helpful to us, and I think it'd be very helpful to the departments to share where they reduced accurately. And I think you can kill this conversation. It's been going on for 2 years now. We're entering into our third, and it's been frustrating for all of us. I know it is for you. It is for us. So I certainly like to see something that can help us in some cases with additional cuts and others defending the funding level we have today.
Thank you, Senators. We have our clock in chambers is inaccurate. It's 10:17. We have the floor at 11 o'clock. We have about 30 minutes for 11 slides. So if you have questions, if you could write them down, we'd be happy to submit them to the OMB director. But if we could provide her some time to get through more of her presentation, I would appreciate that. Ms. Pitney.
So we're talking about the large cost drivers. These are going to be very important for our ongoing cost containment. Justice reform, we're beginning to see some of the benefits of that. I sincerely appreciate your discussion of saving lives as well as containing costs into the future and doing having justice serve society as and individuals as well. And so I think that will need continued watching and looking. It does impact the budget. Whatever we do there changes. You know, the pretrial, we saved in beds for corrections, but we're also putting in a pretrial component instead. Those kind of, there was a reduction here, but there was a cost here. And so we're going to see those things. But if together we do those and it keeps the long-term cost down, that's what we want to do. Or changes, you know, instead of it going up like this, we change that slope a little bit. And so it goes up less steep. Healthcare, again, a big thank you to this body for the Medicaid reform bill and the opportunities it provided. There are many efforts that Health and Social Services is moving on. But there's also efforts with commerce and the private health insurance market. There's the health care authority feasibility study that administration is doing, which was part of the Medicaid reform bill. And we have our employee health cost increases, both for even after significant management efforts on contracts with providers, utilization studies, and so forth, our costs are still going up. Employees are bearing some of the cost of that, but so are we as an employer. Healthcare is a pervasive cost driver in the state of Alaska, not just for state government, but for every employer. And the Medicaid reform bill was an excellent step, and we're looking forward to the next process of looking at healthcare in a more global sense for Alaska. The federal issues are coming up, going to change things, and I hope the next 10 months we spend with open dialogue on this, because it is essential that we look at it from everyone's lenses and with our goal of access to quality care at an affordable price. But this is complex. I think the healthcare authority feasibility study will help guide us, but we're prepared to provide status reports of where we are with the efforts to date and a way that we can bring all of those together for our next look at healthcare reform in a broader sense than just Medicaid. So not ready for action this session, but ready for a lot of education, both for us, for the legislature, for the public, of what the issue is. Now going to education, Commissioner Johnson is getting ready to begin a reform process, very much looking at the quality education for every student, looking at innovation. The school board has set out priorities and goals, and Commissioner Johnson with the school board will begin a reform process shortly. You will be involved in that and invite you to discuss that with Commissioner Johnson as that begins and takes shape. But also a major cost driver that we want better quality.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, so Ms. Pitney, this is on this page, the title is Ongoing Cost Containment, so I'm assuming that the systems reform process is going to be a reduction in the cost of education?
Only because it's placed on a reduction page.
And again, ongoing cost containment efforts. There's cost pressures that are up. And what we want to do is get the most quality from the money we're spending. Can we turn the dial down on education? No. Can we get better quality for the money we're spending? Yes. And it may be possible to get to have less money, depending on how the system is set up. But the way the system is structured, the formula is structured right now, it would probably be difficult. But if you looked at an overall system reform, cost savings, cost containment, and better quality for the money we're spending are our overarching expectations.
So just a quick follow-up, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy.
So if it's not really cost reduction or cost containment, my only suggestion would just be move it to another page that just says other, because if it's not, you have it under a heading that seems to indicate or lead folks to believe that something is going to happen in education that's going to reduce or contain costs. That's all. That's the only reason I asked.
Wait.
Ms. Pitney, please continue.
So on the K-12 budget in this in the 18 budget, it accounts for 29% of our unrestricted general fund budget. It's $1.226 billion. This is money that unrestricted general fund money that goes directly to communities to cover the cost of their public schools. The increase from 17 to 18 for K-12 education is 6.2. The base student allocation cost did not change, but there's an expected increase in students, an increase in students with special needs, and last year we used the public school trust fund at a rate a little bit higher than what was probably reasonable, and so that accounts for part of it. And again, Commissioner Johnson is beginning a systems reform process, and that'll start in earnest as we go forward.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Okay, there are three major reorganization efforts. These are in no way all of the reorganizations. Every department has worked on reorganizations to deal with the constrained budgets, but these are notable ones in this budget. The shared services, Commissioner Fisher has talked about the shared services approach to back office functions over the past year. That is for the first time reflected in this budget. We are moving 70 positions from other agencies into the Department of Administration for the new shared services. We're also including some of the existing Department of Administration's personnel. So the shared services organization in this budget will show 146 positions. Although we've transferred the positions from the agencies will maintain their money, their funding, and they will buy services from the shared services organization. The first year, we expect a 10% decrease in costs to departments. That 10% decrease is taken in this budget. In the following year, we expect to go up to 30%. And we're starting with five functions in that shared services organization, and look forward to having additional discussions around the specifics of that and the opportunities. Mature shared services organizations often can save 50% of operating costs. That takes a while. That's a 4 or 5 year progress, but that's an ongoing effort to improve the way we deliver those back office functions. That's travel and expense, accounts payable, procurement, and so forth.
Vice Chairman Bishop.
Madam Chair, I'll just get with you after the meeting to discuss maybe if we want to have a deeper discussion at finance about this. Thank you.
Thank you.
So information technology consolidation is similar to shared services, but focused on our IT, but having technology become a much more strategic part of our operations. And lastly, the reorganization is Department of Transportation, and this is optimizing project delivery through contracting out more of our design functions in Department of Transportation with the goal of getting more for the money that we have.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Pitney, I can just tell you from me at this table, I'm not in favor of that, and I'd like to have a deeper discussion about that.
Thank you, Vice Chairman Bishop. My questions, Ms. Pitney, will be to look at the economics of what you're doing and what other states have actually experienced when you cut your design team. As I understand it, about 55% to 60% of the design team is already contracted out. I also understand in talking with multiple programs under Department of Transportation that we may have a morale issue problem with some of the changes that are happening and how they're being implemented. So I hope that the administration will reach out to DOT and try to check the heartbeat of that organization and make sure that we're not hurting ourselves by some of the proposals inside of your budget. So we'll look for a detailed analysis on the economics that you've run to implement this piece of your policy.
Absolutely. Okay. So in interest of time, so statewide obligations. These are where we're feeling the cost pressure up. The oil and gas tax credit, statutorily required amount, is now $74 million. That $74 million is based on the formula in the statutes, based on the production value, and because of the price increase, it's increased by from $30 million to $44 million. This year, the school debt reimbursement and the REA funds, the governor had vetoed those due to lack of a fiscal plan. We have put forward a fiscal plan that would allow those to be funded, and those are included in this budget. That was a $40 million increase from last year. The retirement payments, although did not increase this year, there was actually a decrease. We expect them to grow over time, and the legislature did last year, some of that funding is coming from the Higher Education Fund. This would be the last opportunity to use the Higher Education Fund for any items other than the scholarship program and maintain the scholarship program into perpetuity.
Ms. Pitney, could you remind the Senate Finance Committee how much vetoed tax credit obligations are on the book? So I guess there would be two numbers. Yep. The amount that the governor has vetoed over the last 2 years that we still owe, and any new receipts that we have for tax credits as far as unpaid bills go. Mm-hmm.
First, based on the statutory, there are no unpaid bills. There are companies who have tax credits in hand.
The legislature, Ms. Pitney, authorized spending. The governor vetoed it, so it's mm-hmm. all perspective, just right. The numbers.
Okay. The veto in 16 was $200 million, and the veto last year was down to the statutory minimum, and I believe that was $480
million.
$480 million veto.
So if we subtracted the 74 that's statutorily required, we can have some confidence that the governor won't veto the statutory required payment?
The governor did not veto the statutorily required payment last year.
And then could you give us the number, what's on the books waiting to be paid, if not owed?
I'm going to be close. I won't be exact. $700 million in this fiscal year. We expect $1.1 billion by the end of fiscal year 18.
Is that based on just the statutory payment calculation?
That is the accrued credits. There's the payment obligation is the 74.
Thank you.
But that's the accrued credits, cashable credits in hand. Does not count the credits that are that offset tax obligation.
Thank you. Ms. Pitney, on the school debt reimbursement, restored veto, those are unique words. Does that mean your budget includes the $40 million that was vetoed before? Or did you undo a veto? And if so, how?
No. That's a good point, Senator. Senator McKinnon, thank you for interpreting that way. That was not how I meant to have had it posted. We did not restore the 17 veto. We included the state obligation for debt reimbursement in 18 and the REAA funding in 18. The 17 was not restored. The 18 budget is $40 million higher than 17 because of the veto.
Perfect. I just
and my apology, you're right. It is stated that way.
Please, any other questions on that page? Senator Dunleavy.
I don't know if, through the chair, I don't know if Ms. Pitney was going to go to the next page, but before she does, on the bottom, you have the $55 million bill that we got in the waning days of the special session. Is there an expectation that you'll come to us again with a similar amount of money to continue to subsidize, or however you want to word it, the issue with insurance?
So, through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, the 17 budget included $55 million, and the 18 budget includes $55 million. It was a two-year experiment, and I think the federal activity is out there. There are many moving parts on this one, including federal waivers. That is an ongoing discussion, and at this point, I would not be able to say what fiscal year 19 would look like or if this is the fiscal year 18, given the federal side.
Just a quick follow-up, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy.
I can't recall, and I really can't, but was that the discussion last year that it would be a year-to-year-to-year?
Senator Dunleavy, it was not. I'll be happy to comment on that. Ms. Pitney, our understanding as presented, and again, I could be remembering inaccurately, considering it was the third special session that was very time-consuming with not a lot of action. But we did receive a request for $55 million. I thought that the $55 million was for 2 years, actually, and that when I checked the spending on that $55 million, that it was somewhere around 34 and that we still had cost savings. So we'll need to see an accounting perspective of how we're requesting another $55 million if, on my last check, we still had additional funds left from the last appropriation. And then we'll look at language to see how that appropriation went down, because my understanding is that $55 million was to be used over 2 years, not requested for 2 years. And, in fact, we asked the administration to bring us back a plan because we were not happy that in the ending hours of the last special session that we were asked to provide blindly $55 million because the risk corridor of the Affordable Health Care Act had ceased to provide grants to provide for individuals under the Affordable Health Care Act. And so for the people of Alaska who are listening, in that special session, 500 people in Alaska are very, very hard to insure. They are high-risk individuals. Hemophilia was one of the diagnoses that was brought to our attention as extremely difficult to find insurance for, and all of the states in the union were looking to Alaska as the first state to see the ramifications of lost carriers and lost competition because of the environment that we work in. So I'll be looking to Commissioner Fisher to provide us some additional details, as well as was Commerce working on this one, because we had two different issues. So I believe we need to hear from Commerce on this issue also.
Yes.
Any follow-ups that we want on the record before we move on? Senator Dunleavy.
Yes, through the chair, an important one. When this appropriation was made to, as was discussed, to stabilize the insurance issue for those 500 Alaskans, were there guarantees embedded in whatever agreement was made that the insurance company, once they received the money, would not leave us? In other words, could they still receive the money and come to you in a short period of time and say, you know what, it's just not happening. It's we still can't make a go of it. And can they exit after receiving that money? Or are they bound to stay here and provide insurance?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, unfortunately, as a state, we are down to one insurance carrier in the private insurance market. And this isn't for the only for the 500 individuals. This is for any person that does not have employer or employer-covered health care. So anybody that is buying their insurance. So this is small business individuals. It does include some people that have a federal subsidy based on their income that don't qualify for Medicaid. But this is roughly 25,000 individuals who buy their insurance through a private company. This allowed the cost to not go up by 40%, but only 7%. And we are down to one carrier. And this is why this is one of those health care issues that we must look at holistically. And maybe the health care authority study will help us find the right balance and direction.
Thank you. Through the chair, is there a guarantee that, is there something in a contract or an agreement that they will stay, or is it a year by year? They get $55 million and they might go, and then we have to pay them $55 million again, and they might go. Or was the $55 million the idea that would keep them in Alaska for a while? Do we know what the nature of that agreement was?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, Commissioner Laddick and Deputy Commissioner Fred Parity can give you an in-depth view of that contract and expectation, and there will I'm sure are several layers of due diligence.
Ms. Pitney, if we could try to wrap up in the next 10 minutes.
Will do. So this table provides a look at those. I had mentioned earlier that 46% of our funding, state funding, is our grants out the door. They do not stay at the state level. They go to communities. This is just a community view of some of those larger programs. I won't go into too deep. We've covered most of the programs. There are two revenue measures. So unlike last year when we put in several revenue measures, there are two revenue measures in this budget, Permanent Fund Protection Act and Motor Fuels Tax Increase. Permanent Fund Protection Act, from a financial perspective, mirrors the bill that passed the Senate, and we thank you very much for having the courage to pass that bill. Hopefully we can get it across the finish line this year. The motor fuels tax is a multi-phased increase. The first phase would go from an 8 cents to 16 cents, and the second year would go to 24 cents. The Permanent Fund Protection Act solves between 70% and 75% of the budget gap. The motor fuels tax increase, currently we earn about $40 million in the fuel tax, and this would be an increased $40 million in fiscal year 18 and another increase of $40 million in fiscal year 19. So at the end of the implementation, the motor fuels tax would generate about $120 million. With these two revenue measures, we still have just short of a $900 million gap. We hope to work with the legislature on the additional revenue measures, whether that could include or would include a broad-based tax, maybe corporate tax, maybe individual industry tax, to bridge that gap in time.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, I have to ask this question, and we'll probably need more detail on this, but there seems to be a reversal of philosophy in terms of last year it was moving money into the permanent fund, and there was discussions of endowments. This year we're moving multiple billions out of the permanent fund into the CBR. And so it's probably going to take more discussion to try and understand what we're really trying to accomplish.
Senator Senator Dunleavy, this is a budget overview, so we will absolutely dive much deeper on many of the topics that are being presented.
And Senator McKinnon, I appreciated that, and that's why these are very short slides. This is just an illustration of the unrestricted general fund and designated general fund. The draw from the permanent fund dividend would start in, or the draw from the permanent fund earnings reserve would start in 17 and continue into 18. As you can see here, in fiscal year 2016, there was not a draw from the permanent fund earnings reserve.
Ms. Pitney, I have a question on that comment. Does that mean that you're repurposing that money into the constitutional budget return reserve? And if we approved your budget as presented, that the CBR would grow?
Chair McKinnon, the CBR would go to $5 billion in fiscal year 17, and over time, assuming that the spending level stayed relatively steady from where it is today, it would grow. My guess is that CBR balance would probably address some of the capital budget issue needs, but that would be a call for later years. But the CBR would be healthy, and both the CBR and the earnings reserve would increase. And this is the last page. I'm on page 24. Shows what the CBR balance would be under this plan, and this is with a inflation only growth. In the agency budgets, projected growth in retirement and so forth. So you see stability in the earnings reserve balance and slight increases in the CBR balance. Again, this is with a very constrained capital budget, so it's hard to say what the CBR balance would be, but at this spending level, it has the investment earnings would allow it to grow. And it preserves the overall value of the permanent fund, where the status quo could certainly threaten it. I provided two tables. One is a comparison 15-17 to 18, and the other is the fiscal summary. And there is significantly more information available on our homepage. Look forward to the session. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pitney. Are there any closing questions or other items that need to come before the Finance Committee? Tomorrow's agenda, we have Commissioner Hoffback, who will be walking through the fall revenue forecast. I did see Ken Alper. I'm not sure if he's still here. The director of the Division of Tax has been with us for a while. I don't see him here now. Seeing nothing else, it is 10:46. We have a floor session that begins at 11. We're adjourned.